Natalia Anastasia Tiamarovna, guards in a semicircle behind her on both sides, stood before the triumvirate in the great marble hall.
In a few moments, you will be presented to the delegate of Marshal Karamazov. You will be pleased to know that we have just received word that the Marshal himself, although he could not come, was seemingly quite enthused at the prospects of your return, Major.
I am certain that he was.
Do you know a Captain Sarovsky of what is this called, the...
The chairman seemed to consult notes before him on the three-man desk.
The KGB elite corps?
I do not know a Captain Sarovsky. But if he is an officer of the KGB elite corps, I know what kind of man he is. Evil. I will say this only once, but if you truly value the interests of the Soviet people here beneath these domes whom you represent, you will not trust Marshal Karamazov. He has no interest in the welfare or future of the Soviet people or of anyone other than himself. He is a ruthless, perverted butcher. I am not pleading for my life. I am simply making a statement. Despite what I have revealed concerning my defection from the KGB and my assistance to the American cause, in my soul, I will always be a Russian. I left the KGB because I realized that in working to serve their interests, I was working to perpetuate war and toward the eventual undoing of all people everywhere, the Soviet people most particularly. I have nothing to gain by telling you this, because you will turn me over to Sarovsky, and he will convey me to my husband, and my husband will inflict upon me the most hideous of tortures, and eventually, mercifully, I will die. My cares will be over forever. But the Soviet people must not die. The Soviet people must help to rebuild our devastated world, and all people must learn to live together as one people and work for the common good. If you and your fellow members of the Troika trust Vladimir Karamazov, he will lead you only to destruction. John Rourke is dead, and with him went my will to live. John Rourke was a man like no other. But killing John Rourke will not alter the inevitability of right over wrong. There are other men. There are thousands like them, comrades. Germans, Icelandic, Americans, Russians too. They will continue to work for a day of freedom. And many who now serve my husband's evil will realize that what they do serves no one but my husband, and they will join with the forces that fight him. You stand at a moment in history, one that is critical to your survival. If your decision is based on the personal lust for power, your heirs will revile that decision and curse your folly. It is not too late for you, but once you have sold your souls to Vladimir Karamazov, it will be. I have said what I wish to say. Thank you for the opportunity.
The eyes of the chairman were unmoved, as Natalia knew they would be. But conscience forced her to try. They waited in silence, Natalia standing almost at attention, the men of the triumvirate shuffling through paperwork on their desk, her guards unmoving, the muzzles of their weapons unmoving. Her chance would come for death, she knew, but perhaps her death could serve a higher purpose. She went weaponless to her husband once in order to buy freedom for the people she loved. He nearly killed her. This time she would not be weaponless. The razor blade in her boot, sewn in for her by one of the German craftsmen, could slice open the artery in her husband's neck before it cut open her own. Perhaps she would not die in vain. She heard the click of boots in the hallway and turned her gaze toward it. She recognized Boris Feodorovich of the Marine Spetsnaz. He now wore colonel's rank. Perhaps because he was the man whose bullet ended John Rourke's tenuous hold on life. Walking beside him, as though the senior officer, but wearing captain's rank, strode a tall, thin, blonde-haired man in the black dress uniform of the KGB elite corps. The uniform reminded her of the SS of Hitler, as did the men who wore it. His knee-high boots shone with polish, matching his pistol belt and the holster that sagged just slightly by his appendix. His cap sat at the perfect angle, uniformly correct, yet jaunty. As he neared her now, their eyes met, and she could see only cold blue. He walked right past her, came to rigid attention, and saluted the Troika.
Captain Alexei Sarovsky, Elite Corps, Committee for State Security of the Soviet Union. Comrades, I have the pleasure to bring compliments and greetings from our glorious leader, Hero Marshal Vladimir Karamazov, to the government and people of this Soviet state.
Since no one in the triumvirate, although all three dressed alike, was in military uniform, he lowered the salute without waiting for it to be returned.
Greetings, Comrade Captain Sarovsky, and on behalf of the government of the Soviet people, I welcome you and heartily accept the wishes of your military commander, Marshal Karamazov. And here, Comrade Captain, is his prize.
It was the most animated she had seen the chairman as he gestured expansively toward her with a sweep of his left arm.
Thank you, Comrade Chairman.
Sarovsky performed a snappy right face and took a pace closer to her. Natalia watched his eyes.
Major Chemarovna!
He saluted, but had not called her comrade.
The Hero Marshal's compliments, madam. Please, kindly consider yourself under arrest on behalf of the people of the Soviet state for your various crimes against the state. Among these, high treason, espionage, sedition, and murder.
Go to hell.
If the submarine stopped, Michael Rourke could not be certain of it. He had tested the barrier and found it was electrical energy of some sort, but that it traveled in waves and was not solid. By using a strip of blanket from the meager bedding in the cell, he found where the energy was concentrated and where it was not. If the plastic cord at his wrists could not be tugged apart, rubbed apart on the frame of the cot or the edge of the toilet seat, it would have to burn apart. Using more strips of the blanket, he constructed small fuses to put between the plastic cord and the flesh of his wrists, using his teeth. He knew at any moment he could be discovered, but there was nothing to lose and everything to gain.
Oh, come on.
With several of the blanket fuses in place, he dropped to his knees, bent forward, and got his wrists as close as possible to the electrical field, swishing the long, thin fuses of blanket into the edge of the electrical field so they would catch fire. Apparently, disruption of the electrical field triggered no alarm, at least on the small scale which the fuses of blanket produced. Three of the fuses began to burn, getting closer to his wrists. Gently, he blew on them to keep them burning. One went out. The two others continued to burn. One of them already caused the plastic cord binding his wrists to smolder and smell disgustingly bad. A second fuse went out. The third one still burned. Michael closed his mind to the pain the fire caused his flesh. The odor of the plastic was getting worse, and he hoped it wasn't toxic. The plastic cord smoldered and went out. But as he craned his neck and twisted his wrists to better see, he could tell that a small portion of the plastic cord actually burned. He turned around, still on his bare knees, and began tearing out more strips of blanket. Slightly wider this time, so the flames would be higher by the time they reached the cord. If he could get his hands free, when they came for him and expected him still bound, there might be a chance. To do what? Michael Rourke wasn't certain. Sarovsky ignored Natalia and turned to face the three leaders.
You may have already been informed, Comrade Chairman, that just as your excellent undersea vessel was about to get underway, your men and my own had the good fortune of jointly capturing Michael Rourke, the son of the infamous John Rourke, whom the Comrade Marshal had been informed was killed by Comrade Colonel Feodorovich after a protracted gun battle with your late Colonel Kiernan.
We were so informed, Captain. I take it you wish to discuss the fate of this prisoner.
Yes, Comrade Chairman. He is an infamous war criminal. He is wanted by my government so he can account for his crimes.
Michael's only crime is holding my husband responsible for the death squad that caused the death of his wife and their unborn baby.
Sarovsky didn't even glance at her.
I was also given to understand that your Marshal Karamazov had some doubt as to this John Rourke's death. Will presenting Marshal Karamazov with this second Rourke assuage his concerns?
I cannot, Comrade Chairman, speak in that context on behalf of the Comrade Marshal. Yet it would certainly serve, I believe, as a further symbol of trust and a desire for harmonious relations between all the Soviet peoples.
What about the Soviet people in the underground city in the Urals that Karamazov tried to use his poison gas on?
She kept her composure. If she started sounding hysterical, they would likely remove her.
I understand that there is indeed some debate as to the exact nature of Marshal Karamazov's leadership function.
You have been fed insidious lies, Comrade Chairman, by this wretched woman. Who do you believe? An officer who serves the Soviet Union, or an unfaithful wife who betrayed the trust placed in her so innocently by the Soviet people?
You may have the other Rourke as your prisoner. I understand that your rendezvous with Marshal Karamazov on the island of Chinmendao in the Formosa Strait is scheduled for some 20 hours from now. That allows you considerable time to refresh yourself before the return trip.
Thank you, Comrade Chairman. I request that the woman prisoner be transferred immediately to the custody of my KGB elite corpsman and taken aboard the vessel which shall be used for the return trip.
I understand your interest in her safety, but I assure you, Captain, all our interests will best be served if she is allowed to continue her confinement in the detention area below. At any event, I am afraid you must indulge me.
I shall report this to the Hero Marshal.
Then you shall. Please, join us now for a brief refreshment, despite the hour.
It will be my pleasure, Comrade Chairman.
The chairman turned to Natalia's guards.
Return the major to her cell.
The tunnel narrowed, more than the chromatic heat scans indicated it would. Darkwood moved on knees and elbows. The temperature from the steam that traveled through the pipes all around them grew insufferably hot, but there was no other choice. It was impossible to turn around in the tunnel, even if they wanted to. Crawling backwards through the tunnel would only consume more time, and they would still need to find another means of entering the detention area beneath the military office complex. Aldridge crawled right behind him, and behind Aldridge, the dozen Marine Raiders. Ahead, Darkwood saw the tunnel take a bend, and if the chromatic heat scans were still to be trusted, beyond it would lie the entrance into the detention area. Darkwood quickened his pace, reaching the bend in the tunnel, awkwardly moving around it, not envying the Marines behind him. Each man had a Soviet AKM-96 assault rifle and a backpack loaded with ammunition and explosives. Some distance back, the men gave up on worming their way through the tunnel with their gear in place. Now they just pushed it along ahead of them. They brought the AKM-96s for the mission, even though their American rifles were better. Still, the Soviet rifle was good and would allow for ammunition resupply from captured weapons in the field. Darkwood cleared the bend. The low-level lighting in the tunnel made it hard to tell for sure, but he thought he saw a ladder ahead. He quickened his pace as best he could, the knees in his penetration suit, despite the padding, all but gone, as were the elbows. The A2 was still tight in his right fist. As he rubbed sweat from over his eyes with his right sleeve, Darkwood saw a ladder. The ladder went up through a wide-diameter pipe, and he couldn't yet see where the ladder ended. He kept moving, took his flashlight from the pouch on his left upper arm, set it to lowest level only, and moved ahead. Darkwood stopped at the base of the ladder. There was a hatchway that looked as though it were taken off a submarine, but there was no access wheel on this side of the hatch. Darkwood knew this was not a permanent obstacle, only a delay. They carried explosives with them that could blow the hatch. But in the tight space of the tunnel, the explosion would surely deafen them, if not kill them. The explosion would also alert every security man and Marine Spetsnaz in the area.
This isn't an explosives job. Which one of your men has the magnetic pick?
Harkness, job for you. Up the ladder, Corporal.
Yes, sir.
Darkwood pushed past the access pipe. So did Aldridge and Stanhope. Harkness, short for a Marine but solidly built, moved forward on knees and elbows and stood up into the pipe.
Could one of you gentlemen please pass up my pack, sirs?
Darkwood reached for it, but Stanhope already had it.
What's need, Harkness?
The magnetic pick, of course, sir, and the clamps. But I can't get the clamps up here while I'm using the pick.
They're coming up. I'll be standing by with the clamps, Corporal. Tell me when.
Yes, sir. Thank you, sir.
Darkwood hoped their voices weren't traveling through into the detention area that should be directly above.
Keep the noise to a minimum, Corporal. Please.
Darkwood wiped his right sleeve across his forehead again, listening to the scratching sounds of the magnetic pick being positioned. If it worked right, and the operating wheel for the hatch had any ferrous metal in it, the wheel could be worked open from this side. If the operating wheel weren't metal at all, it was back to the unpleasant prospect of using explosives. Darkwood shone his light against the face of his chronometer. Unlike most men these days, he still preferred analog readouts, but digital was necessary, so he saved his money and purchased a Steinmetz, the only handmade watch on the market. It sucked up 2 months' pay like water through a drinking straw, but he never regretted the purchase. Aside from dual display, it was the best diving chronometer made. The Steinmetz showed Darkwood he was running out of time. If he didn't get the woman in time to allow enough travel time back to the docks, and then swim-out time through the sonar tunnel, the Reagan would move from its position near the Pillars of Woe and head for the open sea. Had the situation been as it was when Natalia was in the detention area before, as soon as she was left alone, she would have freed the razor blade from inside her boot top and taken her own life. But she realized now that although she might save herself from further hardships or tortures, she would be acting in a cowardly fashion. There were more important considerations. She might be able to kill her husband, but more importantly, she must attempt to aid Michael. With his father dead, he would be more vital than ever. And it was what John Rourke would want her to do. She was taken from the Great Marble Hall to the detention area. Escape was impossible. Her goals now were not escape, but to reach the submarine where Michael was incarcerated and at best help Michael to escape, at worst be taken to her husband and have the chance to murder him, slaughter him like the animal he was. Her six guards encircled her as they descended the sloping corridor toward the lowest level of the detention area, where the maximum security and suicide watch cells were located. At the base of the corridor, as they started to turn into the special security level, she heard something, and so too, apparently, did the leader of the guard detail. Natalia sensed something. She did not know what. She slowly began focusing energy, preparing herself. But for what? Had Michael escaped the submarine and come looking for her? Had they told Michael she was here? For a fleeting instant, she thought of and almost said aloud the name of John Rourke. But he was dead. There was movement to her right as they entered the detention cell block, and she dodged left. Figures in black darted from an empty cell, others from behind a desk, two others dropped from the ceiling. The leader of the guard detail was the only one armed with an assault rifle instead of a dart pistol. Natalia hurled herself at the woman. She hammered the guard detail leader to the floor, knocking the woman unconscious as her head hit the floor. Natalia grabbed for the rifle. A man's gloved hand reached it simultaneously.
You must be Major Chimarovna. I mean, you do speak English, right?
She tracked the voice to the face, her hand and his hand still on the rifle. He stood over her, crouched slightly, in his right hand a pistol that looked vaguely similar to a Beretta 92F, but with an impossibly long extension magazine.
I speak English.
Good. I'm Commander Jason Darkwood, captain of the United States attack submarine Reagan. You're John Rourke's friend.
There was no hesitation before he said the word friend, as if he were making more of it.
How do you know?
Well, Dr. Rourke told us about you for...
She was to her feet before she realized it, the palms of her hands flat against his chest. His dark brown eyes sparkled with a mixture of amusement and concern, and what she could see of his face beneath the hood that covered his hair and obscured the sides of his face seemed to exude strength.
Jonas!
Alive? You bet he is, ma'am.
She turned to the new voice, a black man, about the same height as the white man.
I don't know if he got the chance to mention me before he fell off that balcony, but I'm Captain Sam Aldridge, United States Marine Corps. John Rourke was being operated on, but the notion was that he'd be fine. At the best doctor at Midwake. So, unless something went wrong, ma'am...
She turned from the man named Darkwood and threw her arms around the Marine captain's neck. She kissed him full on the lips.
Thank you. Bless you.
She inhaled, feeling lightheaded suddenly, as if she were going to faint. She looked at the other man, the first man, went to him, embraced him, and kissed his cheek.
I like that. The Marine gets a kiss on the lips and the Navy guy who got him here gets a kiss on the cheek.
It's the way we roll. That is the way we roll. We fight, you give us a ride.
She rectified the situation and kissed Darkwood on the lips. Then she felt herself going faint and his arms going around her. Natalia opened her eyes. It wasn't a dream. The man named Darkwood and the man named Sam something looked down at her. Her head was resting on a backpack. Both Darkwood and Sam had removed their hoods. Darkwood smiled down at her.
I don't usually have that effect on women, Major Chemerovna.
She felt her cheeks flush with embarrassment.
And I'm not usually the fainting type. It's just that I thought...
I understand you and Dr. Rourke have been close for quite a few years, Major. If you thought he was dead and now you know he isn't, well, the reaction's purely understandable. You up to traveling? I think we need to get you out of here.
That's for sure.
Both of you. All of you.
She looked at the two officers and the 12 men, most of them clustered near her, some guarding the entrance to the detention cells.
I can never repay you.
That kiss was good enough for me.
Darkwood smiled. She felt herself blushing again.
How about you, Captain Aldridge?
Good enough for me too, Captain.
She sat up.
Easy, ma'am.
I'm fine, really.
I wasn't sure what kind of person to expect. We don't usually go around rescuing Soviet officers. And if you're 5 centuries old, well, I've just gotten a new insight into older women.
Please, Commander, or should I say Captain?
My rank's Commander, my position is Captain. Call me Jason, Major. Makes it easier.
Jason, Sam, please, I am Natalia.
All right, Natalia. I think we have to get going.
Darkwood helped her to her feet. Then he handed her a pistol, like the one she had seen him holding. She looked at the flat of the slide.
U.S. Government Model 2418A2, caliber 9mm LC. Sweet.
It had an ambidextrous safety, an ambidextrous slide release, and balanced well.
How many rounds?
30 with that extension magazine, plus one in the chamber. 9mm Lancer caseless. Maximum effective combat range 75 yards, if you're good.
I'm good.
Well, if you're that good, take these.
He handed her a shoulder-slung black bag. It was a magazine case.
Is there a pocket in that thing you're wearing?
Yes.
Here, the standard magazine, 15 rounds.
Darkwood handed her a standard-length double-column magazine, and she pocketed it.
Are we going to get Michael, or is there another team out?
Who's Michael?
Her heart sank for a moment.
He's John Rourke's son. They have him prisoner aboard that submarine that just came in.
She saw a worried look enter Jason Darkwood's pretty eyes.
A little boy, huh?
He's 30 years old.
Then how old is Rourke? He looks like he's in his middle to late 30s.
He is.
Then how can he have a 30-year-old son?
Trust me, there's no time to explain.
Darkwood looked at her.
All right, we try for the son, but we still have to get out of here.
The tunnel, Captain?
Gonna have to be. Were they taking you with Rourke's son?
Yes. I was supposed to be a peace offering to my husband. He's the commander of the Soviet forces on the surface. He has a very powerful army and is trying to obtain nuclear capabilities. He's an evil man. If this Soviet state allies with Marshal Karamazov...
Your husband?
Yes. If there is an alliance, there will be a nuclear war again. I am sure of it. And the atmosphere on the surface couldn't take it. And I think it would mean the end of everything this time, for good.
Friends under the domes have nuclear capabilities and have strong interests in conquering the surface, it appears. Has appeared for some time. You might be right about that alliance.
Jeez.
You're saying that without you as a gift to him, a peace offering, and without Rourke's son, the alliance might go in the dumper for a little bit?
It would be impeded, yes, and for God's sake...
There was an odd look in Darkwood's eyes.
What did I say?
It just sounded odd for a Soviet officer to invoke God.
If it looks like things are going bad...
She really didn't know what to say.
I get the idea.
She wondered if he did.
We're leaving, Major. Stick close.
Darkwood turned to Aldridge, who was already moving further back into the detention cell block.
Sam, have your security stick about 2 minutes behind us and have them pick up any weapons.
Will do. Security team, you have the word?
We have the word, sir.
John Rourke looked at the Rolex on his left wrist, mentally making the adjustment to midwake time. It was 5 o'clock in the morning. He had risen an hour before, slept out with almost 8 hours, restless to begin the day. He showered and dressed, carefully pulling his clothes over his bandages. The dressings on his wounds were composed of another miracle substance that promoted fast healing. The biodegradable bandages would dissolve as his wounds fully healed. Rourke felt good. As he stepped from the bathroom, Ellen, his nurse, turned around from the window.
Don't you ever sleep?
I told you. Some patients are special.
Well, so are some nurses.
Rourke pulled the black knit top over his head. When he raised his arms, he felt a surge of pain.
Oh!
What is it?
Ellen was beside him.
Not my operations.
The forearm wound was nearly healed, as was the head wound.
Just muscle. I'm a little stiff from inactivity, and I think I took a kind of a beating when I fell off that balcony.
Got shot off, you mean? Here, you let me do that. Nice and easy.
Ellen had adopted him, he decided. He let her help get the shirt over his head and help him to ease his arms through the sleeves. As she pulled the shirt down, she started buttoning the placket front.
All dressed up like some kind of damn commando. Where do you think you're going?
If by 6 a.m. your time, Midwake hasn't heard that my friend Natalia is free, I'm going after her myself.
They gonna just give you a submarine?
Well, hopefully. Otherwise, I'll have to take one. Relax, I bounce back quick, and this 25th century medicine is great. I was accessing some stuff off the bedside computer. You work miracles nowadays. Makes me feel like a witch doctor.
Well, it's just stuff. I mean, a doctor's a doctor. You'd pick up on it.
I'll never be able to repay you.
Ellen turned away from him and walked back toward the windows.
Look, I know you're married. I heard that. And I know about this Russian lady, Major.
She turned around from the window very suddenly and came toward him.
But you can always use a friend, can't you?
John Rourke walked toward her and folded her into his arms. She leaned her head against his chest.
Always, Ellen.
Michael Rourke's wrists were blistered, but as he tugged at the nearly burned-through plastic cord, it finally snapped. He saw no one in the companionway outside the brig. The cord could be turned into a garrote, and if he could steal a weapon, even one of those dart guns, he might have a chance. If his father and Natalia were alive, they could be aboard the submarine. If they weren't aboard the submarine, they might be wherever it was headed. There were possibilities, and any place was better than here. Sebastian sat in the command chair of the Reagan. He consulted the digital timepiece set in the armrest, then looked away. The timepiece readout was most distressing. Dr. Margaret Barrow stood beside him.
Are you going to stay, Sebastian, or aren't you?
Margaret, I have orders. Not only do I have orders, but the orders are indisputably correct. Allowing for the maximum amount of time for all facets of the captain's plan, allowing for additional delays that might never be foreseen, a return by 6 a.m. Midwake time is certainly an appropriate deadline. Now, we cannot rely on our sonar drag array and the Pillars of Woe themselves masking our presence here forever. Not only is it my responsibility to await the captain's return, but it is also my responsibility to provide for the safety and the lives of the rest of the crew, yours included. At the appointed time, I will follow orders and head for the open sea. And as soon as conditions of proximity permit, I will communicate with Admiral Ron in order to request further instructions if Commander Darkwood and his party have not returned. Some time still remains, may I remind you.
Barely enough time for them to make the swim.
Jason is quite resourceful, as is Captain Aldrich and Lieutenant Stanhope. Perhaps they will avail themselves of some other means of transportation.
Sure, maybe they'll steal an island-class Soviet sub.
He hardly thought so.
We'll have to steal it.
An island-class sub?
Sure, it'll look terrific over my mantelpiece anyway.
Aldrich didn't smile. Darkwood shrugged.
Look.
Darkwood studied the Russian woman's eyes a moment, then he looked back toward the island-class sub.
If we board that vessel, alarms are going to sound, and in general, all hell is going to break loose, right? We may have time to get aboard, but we won't be able to get back off and into the water and swim out without getting ourselves killed. If there's a general alarm, the sharks might roam free in the lagoon, too. We'd never make it out alive. And we have no idea what condition this Michael Rourke is in, and we might also sustain some casualties ourselves. That'd slow us down even more. But if we take command of the sub, we can shoot our way out.
He looked at the Steinmetz on his left wrist.
And the most telling argument of all, sir, Major, is that we are flat out of time. We could never make the swim out to the Reagan in time to intercept it before Sebastian follows his orders and heads for the open sea. But even if they send an island classer against us, we'll still have a little jump on them and can link up with the Reagan and fight our way home if we have to. Plus, might be nice just to see what's inside the tubes of that missile deck. Agreed?
No one disagreed.
Good. Sam, you go take that submarine for me.
Aldrich opened his mouth to speak, then shook his head, trying to hold back laughter.
All right. Here's what to do. Tom, you and the two guys already in the water, and two more men, swim up to the island class and come aboard from her starboard side by the hydrofoil launch berth. Use the PV-26s unless you feel more force is the only way to achieve the objective. I'd rather we avoid making any more noise than we have to.
Stanhope nodded. Darkwood weighed his pistol in his fist.
Those people on board should be expecting our charming companion to arrive sometime shortly. So what if she arrives a little early, huh?
Colonel Harley Wilkes, the ordnance expert, arrived in uniform this time. By Rourke's Rolex, it was exactly 5:30 a.m. here, meaning that in a half hour, the immediate disposition of Natalia's fate would be known. Either this Jason Darkwood had succeeded or failed.
Thank you for coming at such an ungodly hour, Colonel.
It's not bad if you've been up all night indulging a whim, Doctor.
Rourke looked the old Marine in the eye.
I apologize for the inconvenience.
You should, sir, and the apology is accepted. I believe I have your special ammunition, although for the life of me, I cannot see why our own pistols wouldn't suffice for your needs.
As a soldier, Colonel, you should know that a man fights better with a familiar weapon.
True. Very true.
He opened a small attaché case, took from it a red plastic ammunition box, and handed it to John. Rourke opened it. There was no head stamp, and the brass was a little off color.
There's your ammunition, sir.
Looks good. How does it shoot?
We all but perfectly matched the velocity figures you gave us. There's less powder because our powders are mixed differently and our priming compound is more powerful. Chamber pressure seemed to be quite reasonable, and recoil is not as pronounced as I would have thought this old caliber should be.
Can I try them out?
There's a rifle and pistol range in the academic complex across the way. I anticipated your request. I'll call for a nurse in a wheelchair.
John Rourke stood up.
Yeah, that won't be necessary. Thank you, Colonel.
He judged another 25 minutes remained until the moment of truth. The walk actually felt good. Rourke's perception of his overall fitness level pleasantly surprised him. The air here, despite the fact that it was canned, felt fresh against the skin. The black BDU pants and the black knit shirt were comfortably cut. The mid-wake issue combat boots, with their deck-style soles, made for almost effortless wear. And at his waist, he wore a brass-buckled web belt, identical, for all intents and purposes, to the military issue belts of 5 centuries ago. The education complex was imposing. As they entered, Colonel Wilkes explained the setup of the complex. In addition to the education complex they were entering, there were grammar schools and high schools, serving each of the two primary living areas. This education complex housed special elementary and secondary schools for the gifted, as well as the university and the Naval Academy. The Naval Academy was the one and only military academy and turned out naval and marine officers. The closest thing to an army was the Marine Corps. To maintain an army when there was no land on which they could fight would have been as silly as having an air force when there was no air through which they could fly. There were also security police, who received their own specialized training. Here also were Midwake's specialty schools for doctors of medicine and dentistry connected to Midwake's hospital, the only medical facility aside from smaller clinics. Nursing was as respected a profession as ever, Wilkes confirmed. The requirements in nurses' training were nearly as stringent as those for medical doctors. Here as well were the research centers that provided much of the scientific base for Midwake's technology. The firing range was one of several located throughout Midwake. Civilian marksmanship was encouraged, and each man and woman was required to qualify biannually. The private ownership of firearms beyond military-issue weapons was also encouraged. Most businesses and social organizations had rifle or pistol teams. Crime was almost non-existent. Rourke was reminded of 20th-century literary futurist Robert A. Heinlein's remark, "An armed society is a polite society." The range facility was extraordinary in its completeness and integration of computerization. Targets were controlled by computer and could be used in pre-programmed drills or individually programmed. Hits were immediately posted on a computer screen near the firing positions, as well as velocity at the muzzle and at point of impact. Specialized programs were available to measure reaction time, the effects of perceived recoil, etc. Rourke and Colonel Wilkes were met by a Captain Harriet Bowles, Wilkes's chief assistant in the ordnance section. She had his pistols ready, and when she gave them to him, John Rourke immediately field-stripped the twin Detonics 45s and inspected them. They were indeed well cared for. The manufacturer's skillful combination of subtly different stainless steel alloys used in the gun's production not only withstood the test of five centuries, but the test of salt water.
There were a few minor rust spots on this pistol with your name inscription along the slide top strap, where it's slightly matted to reduce glare. But we got rid of the rust, no problem. Despite their saltwater dousing and their age, the guns look brand new.
I'm not surprised. The folks who made these knew what they were doing, and they did it with pride.
With mild trepidation, Rourke loaded four of the six-round magazines and fed one up the wells of each of the two reassembled pistols. Dry feeding was faultless. He felt encouraged. Harriet Bowles programmed the computer to individual combat. At a flashing light cue, the computer-controlled electronic targets rotated into position. Rourke, a Detonics 45 in each hand, engaged the various targets, the program telling him that he had 1.5 seconds to reload. He had one pistol reloaded and firing and reloaded the second as he continued the string. He looked at the computer screen. All 12 shots from the first strings and 11 out of the subsequent 12 shots registered in the K-zone. The 12th shot registered just beneath the K-zone and on a human target would have been a kill. Functioning was flawless and recoil essentially what he was used to. He worked his way through another 50 rounds, selecting at random from several of the boxes of ammunition provided for him. At the conclusion, he loaded both pistols and stuffed them into the waistband of his trousers beneath the black knit shirt.
Colonel Wilkes, Captain Bowles, your work has been extraordinary. I commend you both. How many rounds are there available to me?
We'd like to keep a small supply for experimentation and in the event the load should ever need to be duplicated for use as a benchmark.
Certainly, Captain. How many rounds are available to me?
Rourke loaded his spare magazines as he spoke.
1,000?
Precisely or more or less?
I'd say precisely.
Excellent. I think it's time I put some to use.
Natalia Anastasia Temerovna walked surrounded by men in Marine Spetsnaz uniforms, with Stai 20 pistols and PV-26 shark guns aimed at her. But her blood surged. She felt a freedom of spirit unknown since her captivity began. She was not only escaping, or trying to, but striking back. Each of the men who rescued her carried in his gear a Soviet Marine Spetsnaz uniform. She thought Jason Darkwood and Sam Aldridge looked particularly charming in theirs. They approached the gangplank leading up to the island-class submarine.
The language is one of the qualifications for graduation from the Naval Academy at Midway. And three times each year, there's a proficiency test that has to be passed. If it isn't, you are sent into remedial classes until you can pass. Good thing, huh?
She couldn't answer him, but she wanted to laugh. She couldn't do that either. They were almost at the base of the gangplank. Two Marine Spetsnaz privates stood guard with AKM-96 assault rifles, but both Darkwood and Aldridge wore captain's rank. The two men on guard snapped to attention as the group approached. Natalia forced her expression into one of sadness instead of one of happiness. She stopped when appropriately prodded by a Stai 20. Darkwood pushed past her almost rudely and addressed the two young privates.
You are not prepared for our arrival? Where is your officer?
Comrade Captain, we were not alerted to your arrival, Comrade Captain.
Consider yourselves alerted now, Corporal. Step aside.
The two soldiers exchanged worried glances.
Excuse me, Comrade Captain, but we were given specific orders that no one... And this other officer?
The young soldier stared at Sam Aldridge's black skin. Darkwood smiled and took a step closer to the young private.
This courageous officer standing beside me was the only man to volunteer out of a group of 15 hand-picked officers for a very dangerous assignment to infiltrate Midway, the success of which was predicated upon his skin being dyed and his features surgically altered so that he could pose as an American of African extraction. As you can see, the effect is quite convincing. And now, as to you, Private, you have passed your security inspection well, young comrade.
Natalia was having a very hard time not laughing. His impression of a Soviet officer was very, very good.
I take it the majority of the crew is ashore, and for this reason your guard is necessary?
Yes, Comrade Captain.
The young man seemed pleased with what seemed to be the current turn of events.
Your zeal in the execution of your duty has earned you a reward, young comrade.
Darkwood's hands were cupped together as though holding something. Slowly he spread them slightly apart. The young private who had done all of the talking leaned forward to look. The second private leaned over to look as well. As Darkwood caught the first guard and his rifle and Aldridge the other, Darkwood looked at Natalia.
It works every time, the old curiosity killed a cat thing.
Very funny. Skin dyed, features surgically altered, shit!
What you want me to say, Sam? The guy's eyes were just deceiving him?
Darkwood shouldered one man and Aldridge the second. Two of the U.S. Marines took the AKM-96s off the guards and also took up their posts as Aldridge and Darkwood started up the gangplank. Natalia looked around them, worried that someone had seen, but the hour was early and she saw no sign that what had transpired so briefly had been detected. In the company of the rest of the Marines, she started up the gangplank behind Darkwood and Aldridge. The gangplank hooked to the hull of the aircraft carrier-sized submarine between the forward section of the sail and the missile deck. Natalia slowed her pace as she saw two officers and four enlisted men coming from the far side of the sail. Darkwood and Aldridge stopped in their tracks.
It is fortunate you men happened along. My comrades and I are on special security detail, and we found both of these men unconscious at the base of the gangplank. This officer with me is in disguise for a special mission, which will entail his posing as an American officer of African descent in order to actually penetrate Midway Military Command. Is everything in order here?
The two officers, both junior in rank, began to speak.
I am sorry, comrades, but I'm afraid that there is only one thing to do.
Aldridge and Darkwood set down their burdens.
Comrade Captain, I do not.
Darkwood raised his left hand, palm outward, signaling for a cessation to the conversation, then turned to Aldridge and the Marines.
Comrade, show these officers and their men what I mean, please.
Six TB-26 shark guns swept up to assault positions and fired once, then again. Darkwood stood stock still as the Soviet personnel almost surrounding him took the hits, staggered, then fell. He looked at Natalia and smiled.
We also take marksmanship training very seriously at Midway. Good thing too, huh?
Aldridge and his men started hauling bodies out of sight toward the sail. Michael Rourke wrapped the nylon restraint around his wrists, both ends of it secured to the thick strips of blanket balled inside his fists.
Guard! Guard! Please help! Guard! Ah!
Finally, someone was coming. It was a solitary guard, his only visible weapon holstered at his right side.
What are you shouting about?
Oh, my stomach! Oh my god! Ah!
The guard turned a key in a panel on the far side of the electrified barrier. The guard drew his pistol and approached. Michael slumped to his side. The guard bent over him, the pistol pointed at Michael's face. The guard touched Michael's head. Michael dodged his head right and rolled his body against the man's legs. The guard stumbled, and Michael was up, stepping inside the man's right arm. Michael's fists wide apart, he twisted the cord around the guard's neck. Michael threw his body weight against the gun arm, pinning it to the cell wall as he tugged at the cord as hard as he could and put a knee in the man's groin. The guard went limp. Michael let go of the cord and let the body slide down along the wall. He didn't kill the man. He picked up the pistol and quickly searched the body for spare magazines. There were none. Michael aimed the pistol toward the guard as the man's normal color returned. Michael shot the man in the right thigh. He watched as the guard started to drift off, his head lolling to the side. Michael checked the man's breathing as he stripped him of his clothes. They neared the hatchway beside the sail. The second Marine Corps officer and his divers came over the side, weapons brandished. Darkwood smiled at them.
Right on time. Secure the deck here. Those are our men at the base of the gangplank, Mr. Stanhope.
Aye, sir.
Then Darkwood led Natalia, Aldridge, and the rest of his Marines into the ship. The scuba gear these men used fascinated her. Darkwood told her they called their gear Sea Wings. They were positioned at approximately the balance point of the supine human body, powered by hydrogen extraction from the water and controlled through sensor leads in the diving helmet to respond to the diver's needs in terms of direction and speed. The wings also eliminated the need for any sort of buoyancy compensator. The helmet was fitted with a hemosponge to extract oxygen from the water. Gas exited through normal respiration with the aid of a carbon dioxide exhaust valve in the top of the helmet. No tanks or regulator were required. He told her the divers could talk to one another underwater. They wore two-layered suits, one layer designed to constantly remain equal to the pressure of the sea around it, the other to duplicate normal atmospheric pressure. Thus, there was an unlimited air supply and unlimited bottom time without need for decompression. Diving could be accomplished at depths that were thought impossible in earlier eras. The wings looked beautiful, almost translucent. She desperately wanted to try it. Natalia held the military pistol out ahead of her like a wand to ward off death as she followed Darkwood and Aldridge down through the sail and into what she realized must be the bridge of the island-class submarine. Electronic gear filled the space. The bridge itself was large enough to be used as a small gymnasium, with seating for at least 24 technicians, computer terminals and communications equipment everywhere.
Sam, leave one man here with me. Major Chimerovna will stay here as well to help out. We'll keep the bridge secure and get things started up here. Toss anybody you find into the brig if you don't have to kill them. We may need some special expertise. Corporal Harkness?
Aye, sir.
You're pretty good at figuring out how to work things. Think if we stayed in contact for consultation, you could fire up the reactors so we could get moving?
I'll need a hand, sir, but yes, sir, I think so.
Let me. My Russian is perfect, and I had a lot of technical training 5 centuries ago. I learned a lot about submarines and nuclear reactors so that I could sabotage them.
Darkwood looked at her. Then he turned to the young man he called Corporal Harkness.
Suit you, Harkness?
Yes, sir.
Major Chimerovna, Corporal Harkness, welcome to the Navy. Stick with Captain Aldridge until he's secured the engineering spaces where you'll be working.
He looked at Sam Aldridge.
I can make do with just one man up here. Everybody stay armed and stay on top of things. We're doing this pretty fast and we could miss somebody. Now move out, and let's find that young Rourke fellow.
Natalia stuck beside Harkness as they followed Aldridge and his security detail deeper into the Soviet vessel. The ship was nearly deserted, confirming Michael Rourke's suspicions that it had indeed come into port. Moving through the vast, empty vessel from deck to deck reminded him of when he set out alone from the retreat, investigating mysterious lights in the night sky he thought might be the returning Eden Project. He only found an old aircraft, its origin still a mystery to him, its secrets dead with its pilot. Now he wore the full uniform of the downed Soviet guard, and he kept his pistol holstered in the event he encountered Soviet personnel, hoping he could fool them long enough to get close enough to take them out. These little dart guns were too slow to take effect and would make better bludgeons. A steady low hum attracted him as he came amidships. The reactor, he assumed. As he turned down into another companionway, Michael came almost face-to-face with a squad of men in Soviet uniforms, surrounding a woman.
Natalia! Natalia, run for it!
He drew his pistol. Something that looked like a bigger version of the same kind of pistol appeared in the fist of the nearest Soviet. There was something that wasn't right. A Russian officer with black skin?
Michael, no! They're Americans!
Michael froze, the gun online, his finger inside the trigger guard, almost drawing the trigger back.
If you don't look like your father looking at himself in a mirror,
you are American.
Natalia came forward and threw her arms around him.
Where's Dad? Is he...
I think he's fine.
Natalia held him tight. Michael Rourke looked into the black man's eyes.
As far as we know, your dad's on the mend. Took a hell of a fall and got himself all shut up. As far as we know...
Thank God.
Michael Rourke closed his eyes and held Natalia tight. Paul Rubinstein first heard the gunfire a couple of miles back. As he drew nearer to it, he stopped the vehicle, left it, and proceeded on foot. It came from the Chinese camp, or very near to it. There was a succession of ridges and valleys, the Chinese camp located on a hill within 2 miles of one of the higher ridges. Paul scaled the ridge in order to assess what was happening. As he reached the top of the ridge, he uncased the Soviet binoculars from the truck. As the autofocus of the binoculars took over, he was able to see the Chinese camp clearly. A defensive perimeter had been established, but it appeared there was little happening. Mortars were being fired into it by 2 mortar teams located well out of range of conventional small arms fire. There was no sign of the gas trucks. He asked himself what Otto Hammerschmidt would have done. The answer was obvious. Move the camp while they waited for Chinese and German reinforcements to arrive and safely escort the gas out of the range of Soviet influence. but he would have maintained the original Chinese camp for appearance sake. There seemed to be sporadic machine gun fire coming from the Chinese camp, aimed uselessly toward the mortar emplacements pounding it. If Paul wanted to find out what had become of his wife Annie and the others, the most logical, if least expeditious, means seemed to be helping out the defenders of the Chinese camp below. Paul Rubinstein started back down the ridge. He could take the long way around the valley and come up behind the mortar emplacements. If he could strike quickly, and if the Chinese still defending the camp caught on, there was more than a ghost of a chance. The gunfire from the original campsite was clearly audible, but the Soviet mortars sounded closer. As Annie Rubinstein stared down into the valley, she realized she was listening to her own future. The Soviet commander, Captain Grubashikova, was killing two birds with one stone. First, taking care of the minor annoyance presented by the original camp and its few defenders. Second, sending a signal to Annie and the others of what lay in store for them once the mortar emplacements at the base of the hill started to open up, once the machine gun crews started to work. She turned her head at the sound of running feet behind her. It was Otto Hammerschmidt.
Frau Rubinstein, Fraulein Dr. Leuten, I have been in radio contact with the original camp. They will not be able to hold out much longer.
Maria Leuten was crouched beside Annie in the rocks, looking down over the base of the hill.
Isn't there anything we can do for them, Otto?
There is nothing, Maria. And shortly we will be in the exact same predicament. The Chinese commander here has hit on a plan for some of us to exfiltrate the hilltop and work our way behind the forces in the valley below. Some of the Chinese, Liu, Rolvag, and myself. If we can get in close enough before they detect our presence, we may have a chance. The question is, Annie, can you and Maria and Mei Lin and a few Chinese soldiers here hold the hilltop while we work our way into position?
Annie smiled at the German commando.
Good. I will let you know before we leave. So now, if you will excuse me, ladies.
He was up and moving, in a low crouch at first and then to his full height. There was no reason to suppose his plan would work, Annie realized, but it was better than just sitting here and letting the Russians come and kill them like shooting fish in a barrel. It was an old expression, shooting fish in a barrel. She wondered if anyone had ever really done such a disgusting thing. Annie turned her gaze to the base of the hill and the Russian forces there. Jason Darkwood sat in the island class's command chair. 14 other Soviet personnel were captured and brigged. The missing Mr. Rourke reunited with Major Temerovna, and Major Temerovna, Mr. Rourke, and Corporal Harkness had brought both reactors to full power.
Sam, pull in deck security.
Hi, Jason.
Darkwood cranked the chair right.
Communications. Stand by for any signals from harbor control. Don't answer to them. Just listen to them. Yes, sir! You're supposed to say aye, Captain Corporal. This is a naval vessel, remember? Yes, sir! Never mind.
He pushed the console button.
Engineering. Reactors still stand at full power?
Everything is ready, Commander Darkwood. As far as any of us can tell.
Give me an educated guess, Major.
Educated guess? We have full power in both reactors.
Wonderful. Bridge out.
Darkwood looked down toward where Sam Aldridge stood over the plotting table.
Time for you and me to trade places, Sam.
Darkwood stood up and stepped down to the control deck. As Aldridge passed him, Darkwood grinned at him.
Lighten up. All you gotta do is exactly what I tell you to do, right?
Right.
Darkwood slid into the helm's chair.
Sam, order the deck crew to take in all remaining lines fore and aft and to clear the deck and notify me immediately as soon as the main hatch is closed.
Right, Jace.
Right, Jace. Sheesh.
They got all the lines cast off and the main hatch is secured.
Marvelous. Hey, sir, the Russian harbor master's throwing a fit. He's demanding to know what we're doing. He is, huh? Tell him to fuck off or the nearest Russian equivalent you can think of. Sam, tell engineering to sustain full power on both reactors and to listen for bells off my console. And for God's sake, to remember which bells mean which speeds.
Gotcha.
Sam, just say everything I say to engineering.
Right, Jace. Ready.
2/3 power to port side. Bow thrusters now.
The dual rudders directly abaft the dual propellers of the island-class vessel supposedly gave them magnificent low-speed control despite their enormity. But he'd never had one of the island-classers to practice on before.
Full power on port side bow thrusters immediately and 15 degrees right rudder. Bring up to all ahead, 1/3, and hold it there.
Jason Darkwood's uniform clung to his sweating back.
Communications, anything new and exciting? Same old shit, sir! Right. Sonar, the stuff making sense to you?
Corporal Lang glanced at Darkwood.
I think so, sir.
Lang was an experienced underwater cartographer, the closest thing to a sonar operator available.
Wonderful, Corporal. Tell you what, if anything funny starts happening, tell me, huh?
Sure thing, sir. A fact of the matter is, there is some funny bumping sounds against the hull.
Darkwood smiled.
Rest easy, Corporal. It's just the Russians shooting at us.
He turned his attention back to the plotter.
Sam, tell engineering to kill the bow thrusters and bring the rudder amidships.
Right.
Then tell them to hold it all ahead 1/3. Lang, get me some bottom readings. If we get less than 15 feet beneath the hull, tell me, quickly.
Right, Captain.
Darkwood realized this was insane, but he realized that earlier, so the revelation wasn't startling to him.
Sam, get the forward video composite up for me now.
How do I do that?
Ask the computer, and hurry.
Right.
Sonar, how are we doing?
Pretty good, sir, I think. It sounds like more bumping things on the hull, though.
Just keep an eye on the bottom and let me know if anything unfortunate's about to happen.
He looked over his shoulder.
Bacon, anything on communications?
They're ordering us to stop, sir!
Even after that nice thing you told them?
Yes, sir!
Goes to show, huh? Hang in there. Sam, video?
I think I got it coming. Ha-ha, there it is.
There was full forward scan on the composite video, and what Darkwood saw matched some of the terrain beneath the lagoon that he remembered from the swim-in.
10 degrees right rudder, Sam, and tell engineering I need negative buoyancy.
Negative buoyancy coming up, Jace.
Negative buoyancy was for going down, actually, but he didn't bother confusing the issue.
Give me another 15 degrees right rudder.
As best he could tell, he got it. The Island-classer went below, but the response was so much more sluggish than the Reagan. He didn't like a vessel that couldn't be directly controlled from the helm, either. It made for slow tactical responses. In his mind, in case he got out of this alive, he was logging away the details of how the Island-classer performed. They would come in handy the next time he met one in combat. He aimed the Island-classer into the sonar tunnel, not to avoid sonar detection, he was too big for that, but because he knew the terrain there.
Communications. Switch to the Soviet emergency band and start repeating that code phrase just as soon as we're out from under the dome. If the Reagan's out there, Sebastian will come running.
Aye, Captain!
Finally, somebody was getting that right, at least. Sebastian followed orders.
Communications Lieutenant Mott, please broadcast the code phrase, bad luck, to Midwake. We should be just within maximum range for interception.
Aye, Mr. Sebastian.
Margaret Barrow had been haunting the bridge before Sebastian turned the Reagan for the open sea, and since. He looked at her now.
Margaret, be of good faith. It would be hard to imagine more competent officers than Jason Darkwood or Samuel Aldridge. We may get permission to return to the pillars.
Mr. Sebastian!
Sebastian turned in his chair.
Yes, Lieutenant Mott.
I'm getting a distress signal off a Russian sub. It's very faint, and my range and direction finding almost puts it right outside the Russian domes.
The nature of the signal, Mr. Mott.
I can't make out the words, Mr. Sebastian.
Keep the code phrase going to Midwake on automatic only, so you can devote full attention to the Soviet distress signal.
He looked at Margaret Barrow.
May I suggest that you return to sickbay, Commander? Since I may very shortly be taking the Reagan into combat, it might prove more advisable than waiting here.
He turned his attention to the task at hand.
Warfare, ascertain that all systems are functional. What is torpedo status?
Fore and aft, 1 through 4, ready to go, sir.
Thank you, Lieutenant. Navigation, proceed by most direct course toward the Russian domes at all ahead, 2/3.
Aye, Mr. Sebastian.
Engineering, reactor status?
Port and starboard reactors, full online, Mr. Sebastian.
Thank you, Commander Hartnett. Communications, what can you tell me?
Sir, I'm getting a lot of jamming, but every once in a while I'm making out some words.
Which words are you making out, Mr. Mott?
Something about Johnny comes marching home, sir.
Navigation, increase speed to all ahead full and hold there.
He already had full forward video display and fixed his eyes on the screen.
Mr. Sebastian, receiving coded transmission from Midwake.
Decrypt?
Computer decrypting, sir.
Darkwood used the final option they discussed just before Jason's departure. He stole a Russian vessel. Julie Kelly turned in her chair.
Sir, I'm getting an Island-classer pursued by other Island-classers on long-range sonar.
Thank you, Lieutenant.
He turned the chair to his left.
Warfare, arm all forward torpedoes.
He turned the chair another 90 degrees.
Communications?
Decryption ready, sir.
Sebastian turned the chair facing forward again so he could watch the screen, then summoned the ship's computer on the console on the chair.
Computer, this is First Officer Sebastian.
Voice print identity processing. Confirmed.
Text of decrypted message from Midway, please.
Processing. Attack submarine Wayne, en route to your position. Do nothing. Message ends.
Thank you, computer.
He turned toward Andrew Mott.
Mr. Mott, use the scrambler. We don't have time for encryption and decryption. Communicate to Midwake that Commander Darkwood has apparently liberated the subject, Major Chimarovna, and is proceeding from the domes in command of a Soviet island-class submarine, and that he is being pursued. Then attempt direct contact with the Wayne, and suggest to Commander Pilgrim that he might care to join us in assisting Commander Darkwood.
An island-classer, sir?
Just relay the messages and hurry, Lieutenant.
Aye, sir.
Sonar, any change in the pattern?
No, sir, except the first submarine is moving a little erratically.
That is unfortunately to be expected, Lieutenant Kelly. The captain is the only one of the raiding party who knows anything about maneuvering a vessel. Estimated time until rendezvous with the lead vessel navigator?
17 minutes at present course and speed, Mr. Sebastian.
Thank you, Lieutenant Bowman.
Sebastian stood up from the command chair, walked down the three steps, and reached to the overhead.
All hands, now hear this. This is the bridge. Captain Darkwood is apparently commanding a Soviet island-class submarine, which has just left the domes and is being pursued by several island-class vessels under Soviet command. The situation is under control, and I will keep you advised. Move to battle stations. I say again, battle stations. This is not a drill.
He switched off and hung up the microphone.
Mr. Sebastian, the Wayne's already responded. John Rourke is aboard her. Commander Pilgrim sends his compliments and awaits your instructions, sir.
Convey to the commander my compliments as well. Suggest that if he has not already done so, he should move to battle stations and stand by. Sonar, how many pursuit vessels?
Aye, sir. 4 of them.
Thank you, Lieutenant. Communications. Convey also to Commander Pilgrim that the commandeered island-class submarine is now confirmed as being pursued by 4 additional island-class vessels. Please also convey my compliments to Dr. Rourke on his restored good health.
Sebastian studied the video composite, and he wished, with the Reagan going into battle, that Jason Darkwood were aboard her. John Rourke stood beside the command chair on the bridge of the Wayne, watching her captain, Commander Walter Pilgrim, with considerable admiration. The man was very good at running a submarine. The communications officer, Maureen O'Donnell, commanded their attention.
Additional island-class vessels. And please convey my compliments to Dr. Rourke on his restored good health.
Signal message received and understood. Wayne out.
The short, stocky Pilgrim turned his chair to his first officer, Lieutenant Commander Bruno Smith.
First officer, order battle stations.
Aye, sir. Ordering battle stations now.
Now hear this. Now hear this. All hands battle stations. Say again. All hands battle stations. This is not a drill.
Pilgrim rotated his chair to face John Rourke. He ran both hands through his thinning hair. His blue eyes smiled.
Appears that quick briefing we gave you on our scuba gear, as you call it, won't prove necessary. Probably just as well. Just out of the hospital, I wouldn't want to try for it the first time either, even if I were experienced in other diving techniques.
What happens now?
We go to battle stations, and so does the Reagan. We intercept the island classes.
Now those are the big ones, right?
Big is an understatement. But both the Reagan and the Wayne are well-suited to outmaneuvering them, and we're faster, by a considerable margin. Jason Darkwood's as good a skipper as they come. If anybody in our Navy could handle one of those suckers, he can. And, I'd venture to say, he's got your Major Tiamarovna aboard with him. We'll get in there and run interference for Darkwood.
I take it that football isn't a lost art at Midwake.
No. Yeah, we play football. And some of us just used to. So, we run interference for Darkwood while he gets himself clear and gets the island classer to full speed. As long as we buy him about 10 minutes and he's got a straight course, the other island classes can never catch up to him.
You make it sound easier than it is.
Oh, it won't be easy, Dr. Rourke. Especially if that island classer's got missiles. And, knowing Jason, he wouldn't have bothered snatching it if it didn't. The Soviets won't want us looking at their little missiles. They'll try to blow their own vessel out of the water before that.
John Rourke didn't say anything more. He turned his eyes to the composite video screen to watch the vessels ahead of them, but all he could see was Natalia. Alexei Sarovsky held his pistol tight in his fist. It was clear to him now that all aboard this submarine was not as it should be. The main hatch had been closed, and at times he had the definite sensation of motion. The ship's engines droned as if straining, yet there seemed to be almost no one aboard the vessel. He heard strange speech. As he drew nearer to the sound, the voices stopped. Logic dictated that the command center of the submarine would be near the central portion of the ship, and probably on one of the upper levels. He made his way in that direction now, his pistol ready. Jason Darkwood set the course on auto and left the navigation station hurriedly, the island classer at flank speed now.
Give me the chair, Sam. Hang loose.
Darkwood slid into the command chair as quickly as Aldridge vacated it. He needed to be in touch with the rest of the ship, and fast. If the Reagan received his distress signal and code phrase, they still wouldn't rendezvous with his vessel's present course for several minutes, and the last thing Bacon pulled off the hailing frequency was that the pursuing four island classers were preparing to fire unless he killed all engine power.
Aft torpedo room, anybody down there?
I am, sir. This is Hornsby.
Private Hornsby, listen carefully, and I'm going to give you a procedure to follow in order to verify that all our torpedo tubes are dry and to ascertain their exact status. Now do exactly as I tell you. And remember, if you open a torpedo tube and the other end is open, we're in deep shit, right?
Yes, sir.
Good. Here's what I want.
Stop!
Darkwood turned the chair around 180 degrees. There was a Russian officer with a handgun standing between the computer and sonar stations near the periscope array.
Who the hell are you?
I am Captain Alexei Sarovsky of the Elite Corps of the Committee for State Security of the Soviet Union, under command of Hero Marshal Vladimir Karamazov. You are under arrest.
Your English is very good. And you are also out of your mind. Shoot me, mister, and this submarine goes to the bottom because I'm the only man on board who can command her. Miss me and put a bullet hole into one of the instrument packages, and we might be as good as dead as well. What the hell kind of uniform is that? And who's this cockamamie Karamazov character?
The Soviet officer's face became livid with rage. Darkwood threw himself out of the chair toward the man.
Sam!
The pistol discharged, and Darkwood felt a burning sensation across his ribcage. His left hand closed over the gun hand wrist, and his right fist hammered forward. With pain across his ribcage, the roundhouse punch wound up a short right jab. But Aldridge was there the next instant. The Soviet officer's body flew away from Darkwood and slammed into the overhead like a rag doll at the mercy of an angry child.
All right, don't kill him. We might get something out of him.
Darkwood's right hand came away from his left side, covered with blood.
No. Oh, wonderful. Great.
He half walked, half lurched into the command chair.
Hornsby, you still there?
Yes, sir, Captain. What happened?
We had a visitor. Stand by. Get right back to you.
He pushed the button for engineering.
Major Chemerovna, Natalia, do you know Captain Sarovsky?
Sarovsky?
Yeah, something like the KGB Elite Corps or some such nonsense. And something about a hero marshal something. Began with a K, I think.
Sarovsky.
If the reactors are all under control, and Mr. Rourke and Corporal Harkness can handle engineering, why don't you duck up here for a second and check out this guy, okay?
Yes, okay.
Yeah, great. Look forward to it. Bridge out.
He cut back to the aft torpedo room.
Okay, Hornsby, you ready?
You betcha, sir.
Go ahead. Inspire me with confidence.
As he prepared to tell Hornsby the procedure to follow, he realized he'd better hurry or this would be his crew's final voyage.